on September 9th and 10th, 2005. A conference on war-affected children took place at the University of Winnipeg. The main focus was children around the world whose lives were changed and still are to this day due to wars in their native countries. Mark Golden, a professor at the University of Winnipeg and one of the key speakers, talked about war-affected children by looking back at the past to analyze the present day.
Well, let's rapidly go back to the summer of 413 BC. Athens and Sparta are almost 20 years into the Great Peloponnesian War, a conflict which consumed almost all of Eastern Europe for some 20 years. The Athenians had engaged a force of Thracian mercenaries to help do them their fighting. They decided they didn't need them anymore. They dismissed them, but they asked them to do whatever damage they could to the enemy on their way home. As they moved north, they passed by the Boeotian city of Mykolaissus, and the Athenian historian Thucydides describes what happened then. The Thracians burst into Mykolaissus, sacked the houses and temples, and butchered the inhabitants, sparing neither the young nor the old, but methodically killing everyone they met, women and children alike, and even the farm animals and every living thing they saw. For the Thracian race, like all the most bloodthirsty barbarians, are always particularly bloody when everything is going their own way. Among other things, they broke into a boys' school, the largest in the place, into which the children had just entered, and killed every one of them. Thus, disaster fell upon the entire city, a disaster more complete than any, more sudden, and more horrible. A couple of things to notice here. First, it is the death of the children on which Thucydides focuses, especially the killing of the school children. This is the climax of the catastrophe. Clearly, the Greeks were very well aware of how war could affect children. The second point is more interesting. Thucydides blames the slaughter on the Thracians. They are responsible for this tragedy. They are non-Greeks, barbarians, and in fact, the tragedy and the slaughter serve to define them, particularly as barbarians. But Thucydides could just as easily have pointed to Greek atrocities against children in warfare. Some who know the Troy story. Thucydides and many of his contemporaries regarded them as historical. You know the story of the Trojan princess Polyxena, a young girl slaughtered as a sacrifice over the grave of the hero Achilles. The story of the Trojan princess Dianax, Hector's baby, who was hurled down from the walls of Troy lest he grow up to avenge his father. And in a particularly horrible example, a horrible version of this story, his corpse is used to bludgeon to death his grandfather as he seeks the protection of an altar of the gods. But Thucydides did not have to look into the distant past for examples of atrocities against children in warfare. He was a general as well as a historian, and he knew well the Greek custom. When a city was sacked, its men were killed, its women and children were sold into slavery. What happened to the children who were too young to be valuable? They were abandoned. They died of exposure. They were eaten by animals. They starved. Greeks committed many atrocities against children in warfare. But it's the Thracians who Thucydides blames. And as it happens, they were commanded by an Athenian. But he said nothing about that in his account. This is a very common motif in the history of childhood. They, whoever they are the bad guys. We don't do stuff like that. Now let's move to the present day. Again, I apologize very briefly. In my business, we're used to these rapid transitions. The events I'm going to describe to you took place after the terrible events of September 11th, 2001. Events which the Americans call 9/11. We do the date differently here in Canada. We call that 11/9. What I'm going to tell you about happened in Australia, where everything is upside down. So for them, that's 6/11. This is during the period of the run-up to the Australian national elections in that year. The ruling party of John Howard pledged to turn away asylum seekers who appeared offshore in the wake of the bombing of Afghanistan. These were hardly a threat to Australian security, desperate and defenseless as they were, but they were mostly Middle Eastern, they were people of color, they were Muslim, very few of them were named Bruce or Sheila, and therefore they were clearly the other, and they were less menacing in less definable ways. Now, there was a photograph which was used by John Howard and his senior ministers to show the refugees' threat to the Aussie way of life. The photograph showed asylum seekers on a boat holding their children up for the camera. These, of course, were war affected children, children who had fled with their families, the bombing in Afghanistan and the resulting turmoil. Why were the parents holding up their children in these photographs? Surely this was an attempt to gain the sympathy of those who might see these terrible scenes. But no, that's not how they were explained by Howard and his friends. The Australian government said that these parents were so eager to breach their nation's defenses that they were ready to throw their own children overboard if they were not allowed to land. That this was blackmail by barbarians. And they also used other photos which were not related, to show that children had, in fact, been abandoned in this way. Now, Howard's ministers were soon shown evidence that these interpretations were not true. But they refused to withdraw their claims. Howard's party won that election, won the subsequent election, and is still in office today. Now you can see the irony here. The leaders of a Western industrialized democracy play on stereotypes of parental indifference among communities and societies of the third world, among other people, in less developed countries, far away, distant in values, it is said, from our own. But the truth is that in doing this, who in fact is showing themselves to be willing to use children for their own purposes? Now, I'm a historian. I think it's always good to remember that the present is history too. And it's useful to take the same cold and critical look at the actions of contemporary human beings that we use when we look at the past. Everything that we do in the present should be done with full knowledge that it can be a model for the future or can be scrutinized as skeptically as I can look at those things that Thucydides said about the Greeks.
Sean Byron, Executive Director of the Mauro Center for Peace at the University of Manitoba, and one of the key speakers, studied 300 young people who were affected by war, and he talked about related issues concerning war-affected children and the way they connect to their own society after being affected by a war.
I think what I found from the study is that young people are optimistic about themselves in general, but were very, from the data, very pessimistic about the future of their countries. They feared a resurgence of the conflict, and felt that while they wanted to be productive citizens in their communities, that they were excluded from the political process. So they were very cautious about their country's future and viewed the legacy of their past with suspicion. So there's sort of a gap between their optimistic perceptions for their own personal future and pessimistic expectations for the future of their country. So that's the first, this gap that was there from these 300 young people. I think a second finding from this study is how these young people were coming of age during the political turmoil of the 1980s and 1990s, that in a sense, there's almost something that we tend to forget about as conflict interveners. Vamik Volkan talks about transgenerational transmission of trauma and time collapse. So how do we end the cycle of trauma that these societies experience? And oftentimes when we intervene in conflict, we're dealing with issues, interests, and so on, but we're not dealing with the collective consciousness and how traumatic experiences impact collective societies, but also young people. And I think this is very important as part of a post-conflict peace-building phase, dealing with traumatic experiences. A third point from this data, again, is how, in essence, a lot of these people became almost alienated from politics, that they seemed to be frustrated with traditional political avenues and were very anxious about a resurgence of violence and how that political vacuum could be filled with extremists. So, in essence, traditional political structure didn't work for these young people. And fourth point is inclusivity. How do we include young people and build them into a post-conflict peace-building process? And I think a number of issues. One of the interventions I did myself in Bosnia, in Mostar, was to create an integrated soccer team by bringing equipment, a very simple, and using that mechanism to teach people about problem-solving and other conflict resolution processes. But I think helping and creating a safe zone or a critical space for young people to develop a critical consciousness is one thing. What Elias Boulding discusses, allowing that space to create imagined shared future is important. In encouraging personal participation, for example, creating mechanisms, dialogue groups, forums for young people to come together to build that self-esteem, and creating interdependent partnerships, I think, is very important. And that involves, you know, creating partnerships between young people and the political structure, the economic structure, and so on. And finally, what I found was that these young people are politically sophisticated in how they looked at the conflict. So in any future creation of post-conflict society, when we talk about a multi-track intervention, it's really important for these young people who will become the future leaders of their country to be involved in that process. Thank you very much.
Miriam Danov, a professor at the University of Ottawa and one of the key speakers, conducted interviews with 80 former child soldiers from Sierra Leone. She also talked about the reason why children become child soldiers, about the demilitarization process, gender differentiation, and social marginalization.
I would like to start my presentation with a quote from a former child soldier that I spoke with while in Sierra Leone. "The rebels attacked my village and I was separated from my parents. They threatened to kill me if I made any attempt to run away. I didn't want to die, so I joined them. I was afraid of being around these dangerous men with all kinds of weapons. I had no mom, no dad, sister, or brother. I was alone for the first time in my life. As time went on and the killing happened every day, we all became used to it. After some time, the violence became part of me." Children were recruited, as I mentioned, through abduction, normally under the threat of a gun. But many other children that I spoke with actually reported joining for a variety of very important reasons. First of all, survival, that the armed group oftentimes provided food, shelter, protection, and often a surrogate family for those who had lost their families. Some reported wealth and power as a means of, as a way of attaining power over civilians. Some were involved in looting as well. In some cases, there was parental, family, or community encouragement to join the armed group, and oftentimes as a result of revenge. In terms of the roles that children actually played, particularly within the RUF, really varied according to their age, their physical strength, and the actual circumstances of the armed group. But what was clear was that failing to carry out one's duty resulted in extreme violence, starvation, abuse, and in some cases, death. But the roles that mostly were for girls involved domestic work, being porters. Girls were also involved in combat activities, which is often overlooked when we talk about the role of girls in conflict. Importantly, girls were victims of profound and repeated sexual violence, and also victims of forced marriage, whereby often euphemistically referred to in Sierra Leone as AK-47 marriage, whereby a particular girl would become the sexual property of a male in the group. Other activities included looting, human shields, spying missions. There was a lot of overlap with the children that I spoke with in terms of boys and girls and their roles, but I want to just highlight that another issue for in terms of the boys, which differs somewhat, was that many that I spoke with actually rose in the ranks of the RUF and became commanders of their own unit of small, what they called small boys unit. Boys were also involved in actually recruiting other children. Now, involved in this militarization process is training. And the children reported being involved in military training, how to use weaponry, and in cases where children felt insecure and nervous about using weaponry, they reported that they were given drugs. And after the drugs, they felt more aggressive and more ready and prepared for combat. There was also a lot of ideological training that was involved. Organized lectures, emphasizing the importance of overthrowing the government. And this made, actually, children reported that it made them more receptive to the cause of the rebels and more willing to fight. There was also a desensitization to violence, calculated strategies to desensitize children to the violence that they were committing. And finally, just briefly, a system of rewards and punishments, that the more destructive, the more aggressive, the more aggressive children were, the greater they rose in the ranks of the RUF. And this often brought greater power, greater privilege, and often command of other children. So basically, there was a severe culture of violence that surrounded the lives of these children. Violence and victimization, whether physical, sexual, verbal, psychological, was an integral feature of daily life. And so in this face of constant violence, a primary compulsion was really to survive. And this often meant obeying any command that was issued. And so what we've seen is the line between being a victim and a perpetrator is extraordinarily blurred. And in fact, children were constantly drifting between committing acts of violence and simultaneously being victims of violence themselves. Another issue that I just want to touch briefly on because I thought it was important was and another element of the militarization process is the discovery that carrying and using small arms were effective ways of obtaining status and power. Children quickly learned that they had immense power over adults. And while girls sort of had a secondary standing within the ranks of the RUF, they nonetheless learned very quickly as well that they too had power over civilians when holding a gun. Now, just very briefly in terms of, I want to move to the post-conflict realities and the sort of so-called demilitarization process and how children actually move from this militarized state to one as being a civilian again. And children reported feelings of guilt and shame, profound guilt and shame for all of the actions that they had been involved in. They also reported extreme, in some cases, extreme forms of rejection and stigma from their communities when they returned home. As one girl said, "Since I came back, I haven't been a year with my people. There's just been problems, problems, problems. They don't love me anymore. They despise me now. I want them to accept me, to forgive me, and allow me to be part of the community." So there's definite social marginalization. There's also an economic component to the marginalization of the children that I spoke with in Sierra Leone, that following a decade of civil conflict, Sierra Leone is plagued with economic stagnation, high unemployment, lack of educational opportunities, and a relatively weak civil society. And so with so few structural supports, most of the children that I interview were living in very impoverished circumstances, having very few viable alternatives. And in response to this marginalization, many of the girls that I spoke with have reported turning to prostitution, petty crime, and drug use in order to cope and survive. Whereas in the cases of boys, I found that many of the boys were actually working in the diamond mines. So under these circumstances, I think there's a natural inclination for some boys and girls to regard peace in a way as largely disappointing. And in many ways, just as dispiriting as the period of war. Because they'll tell you, well, during the war, I had access to money, I had power, I had access to food, and I don't have any of these things now post-conflict. And some actually are nostalgic for being amongst the rebels and the armed group that they were with. And in many cases, this pressure to support both themselves and their families, many children are resorting to violence as a way to express their anger and frustration. And one girl that I spoke with talked about how during demobilization, she wasn't paid on time for her demobilization benefits. And as a result, she organized the children that she was with to go and take drugs and then go and physically attack the DDR programmers. And this was exactly the kind of thing that they were doing with the RUF, to organize, take drugs, and then go into battle. So I think it's often, while it's often former boy combatants that are typically viewed as the security risks in post-conflict situations, the reality of female aggression and anger can't be ignored. So clearly, just in conclusion, children need assistance in the process of adapting to civilian life by providing with a new context and a new identity that departs from their former roles as combatants and victims of conflict. Substantial efforts need to continue in the areas of family reunification, community sensitization, and on providing educational support and creating opportunities for employment, and in particular meeting the psychosocial needs of former child combatants, with a particular attention to gender differentiation and the special needs of war-affected girls. Thank you.
Sasha Trudeau, filmmaker, journalist, writer, producer, contributing editor for Maclean's, and a director of Canada World Youth and the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation, and one of the key speakers, talked about what he calls resource wars and about the so-called rules of conducting wars.
I personally have great doubts that any war can be humane. The battleground is always the home, the hospital, the school. So if we have a problem with war-affected children, we actually really have a problem with war. There's no distinguishing the two. I want to raise a point about, I guess, what I would call resource wars, which I'm afraid we'll be seeing more of. We have been seeing many, and we'll be seeing more of all the time. And there's a character to it, which is genocidal. And the genocidal war is not only on the large scale, which we know of in places like Rwanda, but it happens in a very micro scale, where to aim at your enemy, you cannot just aim at the adult man enemy with the weapon, but you aim at his support network, his ability to feed himself, his family, his children, his legacy. Whereas if you leave his children alive, they too will become your enemies. So you eradicate them all. This is a common occurrence, and it's part of the main factors of war-affected children. The other element I wanted to say is that, as I say, I have my doubts about a humane war, whether it's possible. We like to think that there are rules to waging war, and we are trying to impose those rules on places like Sierra Leone and Uganda or Cambodia or Colombia, and do that from our mighty spaces. But these rules are continuous with the rules we give ourselves, and I just want to raise the point of Guantanamo Bay, where currently there are children there being imprisoned. More scandalously still, there are Canadian children there. And I'm not going to name anyone, but I will shame the families that bring their children to war. I will shame the governments that imprison children in the name of some, and call them illegal combatants, and imprison them without charge, without sense of an end. And I will shame the governments that do not protect their citizens that are in prison, especially their children that are imprisoned in such places. These are the rules of war, and they're not being respected by the most powerful countries. If the rules of war, if we come up with these kind of terms in these kind of places, as Guantanamo, how do we expect to protect the children in much less privileged places with some kind of rules of war that we would impose on them through whatever institution? That's all I have to say.
You have just listened to several speeches given by Mark Golden, a history professor at the University of Winnipeg, Sean Byron, executive director of the Maru Center for Peace at the University of Manitoba, Miriam Denoff, a professor at the University of Ottawa, and Sasha Trudeau, filmmaker, journalist, writer, contributing editor for Maclean's, and a director of Canada World Youth and the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation, who spoke at the War Affect the Children conference on September 9, 2005 at the University of Winnipeg. My name is Bojan Dulabic, and you are listening to CKUW's The Beat, 95.9 FM Winnipeg.